Shrink Wrap Radio number 342, exploring archetypal patterns with Jungian analyst Michael Conforti.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Michael Conforti, and we'll be discussing his research into archetypal patterns. Michael Conforti, PhD, is a Jungian analyst and is the founder and director of the Assisi Institute. Dr. Conforti's work has resulted not only in a training institute based on his discoveries, but also the development of a new discipline, archetypal pattern analysis. He has been a faculty member at the C.G. Jung Institute in Boston, the C.G. Jung Foundation of New York, and for many years served as a senior associate faculty member in the doctoral and master's programs in clinical psychology at Antioch in New England. A pioneer in the field of matter-psyche studies, Dr. Conforti is actively investigating the workings of archetypal fields and the relationship between Jungian psychology and the new sciences. He has presented his work to a wide range of national and international audiences, including the C.G. Jung Institute of Zurich and the Jungian organizations in Venezuela, Denmark, Italy, and Canada. He is the author of Threshold Experiences, The Archetype of Beginnings, and Field, Form, and Fate, Pattern in Mind, Nature, and Psyche. His articles have appeared in Psychological Perspectives, the San Francisco Jung Library Journal, the Roundtable Press, World Futures, the Journal of General Evolution, and the journal Spring. Dr. Conforti is a senior fellow of the James McGregor Burns Academy of Leadership at the University of Maryland. He's currently working on a new book, When the Gods Are Silent, Awakening to Meaning and Healing. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Michael Conforti, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, the pleasure is mine. I've been hearing of your work over the years, and so I'm really happy to have this opportunity to speak to you and one of the people who has been very faithful about making announcements about the various activities that you have going on is Bonnie Bright of the Depth Psychology Alliance.
Bonnie Bright is a gifted woman who is doing, she's probably one of the premier people in the entire field right now, promoting Jungian psychology and creating this online forum. I think she's got probably over 3,000, 3,500 people at this point from all over the world, and I have the highest regard and respect for her and appreciation.
So. Yeah, I do too. I feel very happy to have the sort of strategic partnership with her that we have going on. You're a Jungian, and I'm always interested in the stories behind a person becoming a Jungian analyst. I know it's not necessarily an easy thing to do. Maybe you can tell us the story of how, in Joseph Campbell's terms, you got the call.
It's interesting. I also love the idea of a backstory. I agree with you. There's always a backstory.
Yes.
Probably even more interesting, or at least as interesting.
Right.
There are a couple of pieces that are part of this backstory. I grew up in 100% Italian culture. My grandfather's from Calabria in southern Italy. My grandmother's from Sicily. And my other grandparents are from Salerno, out by the Amalfi Coast. And there was always a sense of another world. You know, we go to the house and visit, and especially my father's parents, they really maintained the tradition. They never really assimilated to America. It was all Southern Italian. And we were raised really Sicilian. And I remember going into their house, and they may be five blocks away from us, and just even the aromas of the house. The aromas of the house were different from any other house.
Oh, I can imagine. Italian cooking.
It's Italian cooking. It's the old Italian Di Nobili cigars they would smoke.
Uh-huh.
And it was the winemaking. My grandfather probably made 500 gallons of wine every year. And like a lot of the people that make wine, he would give it away. It's just a wonderful thing to do, the generosity and the spirit. And you make it because you want to share it. And then it was a dialect. You know, when when I go to my mother's side, they all spoke Neapolitan. And it was an interesting sound, and I was aware at a young age, even though I wasn't speaking Italian, but we hear it a lot.
Yeah.
My mother wouldn't let it in the house. But it was a sense of, especially with the Sicilian, this is very old. This is a really old, old culture, and the traditions mm-hmm. were so strong. The sense of family, the sense of the worshiping of the mother, the deep regard for the father, and how this guy, he had 11 kids, my grandfather, and my grandparents. Wow. And the kids were at that point, when I was growing up, they were all still alive, and they were there at least once or twice a week. All the kids came, and all the cousins were there. They call you Dave or Dr. Dave. It was, to this day, these are the best experiences of my life.
Oh, I can imagine how rich they are. What a rich background. Huh. I've been to Italy a couple of times and loved it. And last time I was there, I was on the Amalfi Coast.
Oh, God.
And so I can understand how it is that you do these programs now at Assisi in Italy. Every summer you do a program there. But back to your story of your call.
Well, I think a lot of it began by the power of knowing there was another world. And I remember, to kind of fast forward for a second, and we'll go back and forth, when I began training at the Jung Institute in New York, I began really young. I was 26, and pretty unheard of back then. And one of the teachers said, well, talking to the whole class, when did you know there was a sense of self? And the other world, this other world of the archetypes and the transcendent. And everyone's like, let me see, scratching their heads and opening their notebook. And I put my hand up. He said, yes, Michael. I said, being in my grandparents' home. And he knew. He was from Israel.
Uh-huh.
He knew about the power of tradition. And that began the whole journey there. So that was a very big part of it. And so we always had traditions, the food, the language, and the love of the other culture. And so that was really the start. The other one was growing up Roman Catholic. And, like many of us that survived the Catholicism, it was a very rich background for me. And I grew up at a time where there was still at the very end of the period when the masses were in Latin. And, again, you didn't know what was being said, but you knew you were brought into something.
Yeah, yeah.
And then 40 years later, 50 years later, I begin reading, both in Jung and also in mythology, they say there's a term called anamnesis, which a lot of it means that when you go into the time of the Catholic Mass, for instance, the benediction and transubstantiation, the early Christians really believed that wasn't a ritual. You were literally brought back, the word anamnesis, you're brought into an eternal time where this stuff is really happening. It's like going into opening a door to a movie house and the movies are ongoing.
Yeah.
That's what they believed. And Jung wrote about this in detail. And, I had no words as a kid, but I felt there was something big. We went to church, we did, meet your buddies and girls and guys and all that. But for me, it was also, in addition to all that regular stuff, I knew there was something there.
Yeah, you had a chance to live in the myth rather than sort of being an outside observer, intellectualizer about it.
That's a great way to put it. I lived in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a big part of the backstory. And then more officially, I went to a place called Goddard College in kind of northern Vermont. I went to City University first 2 years in New York, then I transferred, and they said you could study anywhere in the world. And I said, well, I'm going to go to the Jung Institute. What's that? And I remember reading about it, and I was having, and this is very strange, but I was having a series of dreams about some analysts I never even heard of.
Wow.
And I began reading about it, And I was remembering when I was in college, the first 2 years, one of the teachers mentioned two words. He mentioned the word alchemy and the word anima. I had no idea what he was talking about. I was going to be a phys ed major my first semester in college.
Uh-huh.
I was going to be a phys ed. Then I changed after day two. But he mentioned those two words in the class. I think it was in my first year of college. And I said, I don't know what they mean, but there's something here for me.
That's interesting. So even as an undergraduate, then, you got to go and do some study at the Jung Institute in New York?
Well, it began at that point. Then I went to the Goddard College for my last 2 years, and you go anywhere, and they said, I'm going to go to Switzerland to become an analyst. Now, I didn't read fine print, Dr. Dave. I sent over some money. I'm going to go. I go over with a friend who's going to be in Europe for 3 months, and I get there. And we show up at the Jung Institute. It was still in Zurich at the time. And I said, well, I'm Michael Conforti. He said, oh, so you're Conforti. I'm thinking, well, I guess they know about me already, huh? They said, we're waiting for you because here's your money. Go home. You're too young.
Oh, yeah.
And say, come back. Come back when you're older. But, you know, go do a Jung tour. Take a Jung bus. You know, they're kidding. But, but they said, you know, you're way too young for this. I was 19 years old.
Wow.
And, but you talk about a backstory, it was already cast.
Yes.
The thing was cast. And I think the major issue was it was a real sense of we have to live in the world as we see it. We do our sports and our food and all of that stuff. But you also know there's something else. There's something else guiding it. And that I had since I was really, really young.
Well, speaking of something else guiding it, for a number of years you've been working with what you call archetypal patterns. So what are you getting at there? I mean, we've heard the term archetypes, but this idea of archetypal patterns seems like it's maybe got something of a different spin to it. What are you getting at with that term?
Well, if I can give you the longer story, longer version of this, I had a mentor for almost 25 years. His name was Dr. Yoram Kalfman, the man from Israel I mentioned before. And he was probably the most brilliant person I ever met in my life, and the man who understood psyche in such a deep way, in such a profound way. And what he would do with dreams, I said, my God, how could anybody know so much about a person by looking at a dream? And he was looking at patterns. Now, he was a physicist before he became a Jungian analyst, so he had an interesting background. So I saw that he was looking at images, and you know, images were clustering in dreams, and from the clustering, he'd be able to say, well, I think the issue is about A or B or X or Y. And he got, I got to say, 80, 90% of the time, he got pretty damn good validation. So I was off, and I began really studying and studying and studying, and I began really studying patterns. I mean, being an extrovert, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me because I'm taking in a lot from the outer world. Introverts have a very different experience. And I'm always looking at patterns, you know, whether it's the way a restaurant, how you go in a restaurant, how you feel the minute you walk in, or how they serve the bread, the quality of the wait staff. And I realized, you know, so no matter what example, even with the restaurant, I realized you can make a pretty accurate rendering about the nature of that restaurant by how they serve the bread. And people think you're crazy. And then I began looking at dreams, and I said, my God, you know, not only are these about archetypes and all, but you begin to find that archetypes begin to coalesce into recognizable patterns. That was the key for me.
Uh-huh.
And in other words, you have a story. I mean, take any of our movies and great literature. You have a coherent presentation of an archetype, and the coherence comes through by virtue of the pattern. And so say a movie, I've worked in the movie industry for about 10 years now as a script consultant. You take a movie like Miracles, the one about the hockey team, America, I think 1978, 79, American hockey team when they beat the Russians. And it's a great story.
Yeah, I think I saw it. I think I saw that one.
It's a great, great film. Kurt Russell's in it, and actually my cousin made it. They wrote it and produced it.
All right.
And anyway, the one scene tells you the archetypal pattern. It's this group of ragtag American hockey players. Some drink a lot, some drug a lot, some do a lot of things, but they're all good hockey players. But they're young guys. And then one day they go on the ice, and they go up against these giants of these Russians with shoulders 8 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably all about 6'8", you know.
Yeah.
They're monsters. And these Americans, just the great image, they're looking straight up, say, we're playing them? No one ever beat them in like 20 years. So anyway, you watch the story, and of course, eventually, and it's a true story. It's all totally true, where Americans beat the Russians, and forget Cinderella, whatever. They did it. And one of the reasons that story captivated so many Americans when the Americans actually won, I mean, I don't care about hockey, it's not my thing, but it was captivating because it's an archetypal pattern in a story. This is David and Goliath.
Yes, I was just thinking that very thing, yeah.
I mean, when you go up against seemingly, against odds that you can never beat, an adversary that you can never do anything with, and then somehow you beat it, I mean, whether it's you know, how we win against diseases today. I don't want to say win or lose, but, you know, when we're able to make a life and sometimes get beyond the disease, whether psychological or physical, or other things that we have to face in our lives, say, you know what, can you really make it? And this seems bigger than me. And many of us have been in situations like that with traumas and tragedies. Say, this one seems bigger than me. Can I really go out after this and greet the day the next morning? And somehow many of us do.
Oh, yeah. Now, you talk about patterns in nature, and in fact, you refer to nature and find patterns there. And, of course, Jung felt that the psyche is part of nature. And so what are some examples of archetypal patterns in nature?
Well, if I can begin with patterns in nature, because, again, thanks for picking up on it. It's huge. Jung was a naturalist. I mean, he wrote throughout the collective works, he said many times in many different ways, if you really want to understand something about psyche, look at the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the growth pattern of trees. Look at the growth pattern, look when trees are not thriving. Look at the population patterns in with fish in the water. Look at the, you know, look, just look and look and look. And I remember my grandfather, who I mentioned a couple minutes ago, he was a mushroom hunter. And he would go out in Brooklyn, you know, of all places. He would go to Diker Park in Brooklyn and go looking for mushrooms, and he would find mushrooms. And I had developed an interest in that as well. And it's so interesting in that you go out one day and there's nothing there. Sam, no mushrooms. Well, I can't find any, okay? And you go to the spots where you think they should be, right, or where they generally would be. And they're not there today. They're not there tomorrow. In 3 days, they're still not there. Then you get a rainstorm. And lo and behold, the next day after the rainstorm, there's a whole group of mushrooms under the tree where there was nothing 3 days before, 2 days before.
Yeah.
And I got excited. I said, my God, this is a hand-in-glove fit between field and form. That there is a field that holds in abeyance, that holds in potential form. Form then needs some very particular conditions in order to be expressed. So I said, my God, this is a breakthrough for me to understand. I mean, this is no rocket science for anybody, but it was my breakthrough because I was understanding it. I said, you know what? There's not going to be these particular kind of mushrooms unless you get rain and you could be here. And so all of a sudden, there's rain and there's mushrooms. And then I began playing this game with my son, saying, where were the leaves before they came out? And that was a wonderful article that Robert Henderson put together in a book on the Jungian interviews, that series he does. And that's what I called that interview he did with me. And I would do it with my son. He said, Chris, where are the leaves? We're in winter. There's no leaves, but they're going to be here another 2 months. And I really got into this whole thing about form and where form is held. And that form is even when you don't see it, it's already implicit.
Yeah, I listened to one of your teleseminars recently, and you said something along the lines of field comes before form, which is really a nice little mantra. It almost sounds Platonic, Plato's idea that things exist somewhere in an ideal space that before they manifest themselves.
I think we have enough biological and psychological proof that that is, in fact, the case. And that's what I was finding with these studies. And the comment that you're referring to is something that really has been, I don't want to say fundamental, but it's been just so pivotal in my work and work at the CC Institute. And that was a comment made by Dr. Irvin Laszlo, one of the world's foremost systems theorists and a faculty member for our group for many years. And he said, yeah, if you look at any living system, field precedes form. And, you know, we're scratching our heads. Well, it sounds great, and we know it's brilliant, but what does it mean?
Yeah.
And what he was getting at was he was talking about an example of regeneration in animals, like regeneration starfish and eyes of newts and all that. And he said, well, the form is already implicit in the field, waiting for, not waiting, but being there until a particular prompt came. And the prompt would then trigger the reemergence of that form that's held in abeyance, that's held in potential. So in other words, I mean, you go there, you do a terrible experiment. You cut one of the limbs off, what do you call it, one of the appendages off a starfish, and it's going to grow back. Or you do it with a salamander, and they grow back. the biological things we don't need to get into right now. I mean, they're very interesting to talk about. But what you begin to find is the image of wholeness, the five-finger prong of a plant, the five or six appendages, whatever they are, of a starfish, the design of a salamander. That design, and this is what's incredible about in terms of the psyche as I began making my bridges, the wholeness that's already in the design is not mutated by temporal changes in it. Now, translate. You could take that, again, you cut one of the appendages off the starfish. And so you say you had five to begin with, you got four now. And in time, it will grow back. The original morphological, the original design of that animal is not affected by the fact that you cut it off. Where are we? February 23rd at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That doesn't seem to matter. Because that wholeness and the shape that's there will come through yet again and again. And this was proven in the early experiments in the 70s. You may remember some of this stuff. The days of LSD and more, when they were experimenting, there was money for research, and they were working with Curlian photography. And that's
how they found this. Yeah, I knew some of those people. Yeah,
but they were great. They were doing great stuff. And they would get, a five-prong leaf, put it on a photographic plate, cut one of the appendages off. They take a picture of Curlian photography, and they got a five-prong leaf. They said, wait, something must be wrong, because we just cut off that fifth one. They did it again and again. And they found, again, the wholeness was unaffected.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't that beautiful when you translate that to the psyche? Oh, my God.
Right. Say a little bit about that. Do that translation for us.
Yeah, well, what you begin to realize is, look, many people go through traumas. I mean, I tend to specialize in my career in dealing with a lot of severe traumas and people that somehow have this stuff to make and realizing, when people can't.
Mm-hmm.
But the sense of a spiritual life, the sense of transcendence, the fact that the archetypal process continues to work in these people, it doesn't seem to be dramatically changed. Even if you can't reach the way others can reach or reach the way you could have if it wasn't such trauma in your life, that image of who one could be is still alive. And even we say, look, maybe I can get 3/4 of the way up that ladder. Or I can go down 3/4 of the way down into the depth that I need to go to. The picture of the depth and the ascendance remains forevermore. And that's just an incredible thing to realize.
Yeah, were you just making reference to the phantom limb phenomenon as well as part of that?
That's the sense that,
hey, I have this arm, I can feel it, it itches, but it's not there, or
yeah.
I feel like I can move it, but it's not really moving. But somehow that pattern is established in the psyche.
Exactly. And that's why you begin to see from the biological patterns, the patterns in the natural world, you begin to then see, wow, these patterns in the outer world are all created in response to some eternal design. And there's a wonderful systems theorist named Eric Yance, and he said, science is about to recognize the presence of universal tendencies. And he went on to say that if you understand what happens in biology, you understand what happens in art, you understand what happens in economics, you understand what happens in dreams or individual life, you begin to see that all of these are responding to some natural process that's alive in the human psyche. Everything becomes some expression of it. From the branching patterns of a tree to the branching patterns of the blood vein. And then you begin seeing in the psyche how we begin going about our business, how we begin to express interest, say, in a prospective partner, when you're dating, or how we deal with, I just turned 60 this year, and it kind of hits like a brick, the reality of it. And then you say, my God, you look at your behavior and say, that behavior is clearly part of the midlife and beyond stage of life, from the behaviors and the proclivities and interests that come up and the things that you were interested in before you're not so interested in now, and you realize, wow, this all fits a picture.
Yeah. Now you draw upon another concept from systems theory, self-organizing systems, which sounds magical.
Well,
Something
Jung
about
was really
that.
The first to talk about this stuff in psychology. He went so far as to say, I think we forget this today, that even psychosis is a self-organizing process. That and the guy that wrote about that was John Perry, one of the
early. Oh yeah.
And he would work with psychotics, and he saw in the drawings of psychotics, in the fantasies, and whatever, he saw that there were these, again, archetypal patterns working of dismembering, reconstitution, things coming together in new order. And he, and Jung was saying, my God, you know, there is this high level of self-organization in the psyche. And in systems theory, which, you know, I spend time with a lot of these leaders right now, and I love the work. I love it not because of the idea of system, but because of what it tells us about nature. And you know, Einstein said, I don't give a damn about math. I'm not trying to offend any mathematician that might be listening. He said, I care about math and what it tells us about nature. That's what I'm interested in. But anyway, you know, you're looking at the self-organizing tendencies in the outer world, and my God, there seems to be, and you want to use the forbidden word, there's some wisdom here, there's some intelligence guiding this stuff.
You know, Michael, I am on Skype calling out to you, and it feels like the Skype quality is degrading. So what I'd like to do is hang up and call you right back.
Okay. Hello?
Yeah, that sounds better.
That okay. Now, you ask about self-organization. It's a great, great, I don't know if you want to pursue that piece, but it's a very important aspect of Jung's work that is finding a lot of parallels in the outer world today.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, isn't that one of the theories about life, that life in itself sort of thrives on that idea of self-organizing systems?
Well, you know, yes. The simple answer is yes, and you're heading to what I think is probably the most important aspects of Jungian psychology and what is the most important thing about the CC Institute, my work, and something that really is, I think, being diminished in Jungian circles today. And I'll put myself out and I'll say that. Where Jung was so brilliant in his work was he understood there was a natural order to life. I mean, von Franz used the term, which I love. She said, archetypes are nature's constants.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning the patterns we look at, the patterns of transitions in our lives, the patterns of marriage, the patterns of children and all that we do. And Jung, you know, really was building on that for so many years by saying there's a natural cycle of life. The whole story of Easter, which we're getting close to Easter right now, is part of the cyclical myths. Christmas is part of the cyclical myths. And he said to understand life, you need to understand something about these natural cycles. And it's the same thing with whether depression, whether sadness, whether jubilation. And really, Jung spent a lifetime, and the early Jungians spent a lifetime studying the images and meanings of these cycles. And they looked at the symbols, said, well, that symbol or those couple of symbols are part of a pattern of moving into winter.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're moving into winter, certain things are going to come with that. I mean, I don't mean just the outer world winter, but, you know, moving to the winter of life.
Yes.
How much did, you know, Jim Hollis and the colleague Ari Maidenbaum, who's been doing programs in Ireland for years on midlife? There's so much about the symbols, the archetypal pattern of midlife. But anyway, when you mention self-organization and mystical and all that, on one hand, it seems incredibly mystical or to say that something really would know that as we move into this life, there are certain things we need to do and certain things we need to throw overboard because they're not going to help us on this journey. That's the beauty that I think Jung brought to the world. And I think where that's being, if I could say, where it's being lost today, was Jung cared about the archetypal. Jung and von Franz and Barbara Hanna and Anilia Yaffe and all the great early ones, Mario Jacobi, these people, they knew psyche was alive. They knew that there was a wisdom. Listen to your dream. They looked at dreams as like the gods coming to you and saying, look, no, don't take a right turn. Move to the left. It's to the left.
Yeah. Now, did James Hillman kind of bring that emphasis back in?
James, he did phenomenal work. Yeah, he brought it back. And you know, he understood it. He would say, it's not what gods you have, it's what gods have you, what archetypes have you.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's the transition and the translation, Dr. Day, that's really powerful because where many people then begin talking about archetypes, if you really look at what's happening today, and I, again, I'll put myself on the line here, I think Jung would be rolling in his grave if he saw how it is that we've taken these universal motifs, these aspects of the antique soul, these vestiges of psyche that have been with humanity from the beginning of time, that have eternal meaning, that we've made this into one big drama where we say, Dave, what do you want this to mean? What does Christmas mean to you? What does Easter mean to you? Mm-hmm. What does it mean that you went to Amalfi? What does it mean that you went to Amalfi? What does the image of the Night Sea Journey mean to you? Well, to me, it means having a couple of drinks and a cigarette and making love. You know, and what's happening is everything is being, so much of the beauty of these innate images are being run through the sausage grinder of contemporary biases and our own personal complexes.
Okay, so that's clear.
Yeah. And I think, again, the beauty of where Jung was leading to say there is some inherent meaning. I'll give you one example, okay, the beauty of this.
Yeah.
Dr. Kalfin wrote a book, one of the best books on images ever written. It's a little book, and it was published right before his death. And a wonderful man named David Rotman actually helped with that, and I helped with the process as well. So anyway, he gives one example in this, many examples, but one in particular that's stunning. Someone dreamt that they were outdoors camping, and then they begin to just say, I've got to go to the bathroom, and they go urinate on a tree. So kind of a fun thing men do, right?
You know, yeah, right.
Part of the freedom of being outdoors.
Yeah.
Anyway, and next part in the dream, so he does that, and all of a sudden, 2 minutes later, he looks down at the ground, and there are hundreds of ants on the ground. So a man presented this dream to Dr. Kalfin, and Kalfin said to him in no uncertain terms, my dear sir, you are diabetic. The guy said, what are you talking about? I'm not diabetic. He said, you're diabetic. He said, well, fine, whatever you think. And so anyway, Kalfin said, please, at least humor me. Go to the doctors and get your blood work done. Well, long story short, is the guy turned out to be very dangerous by a diabetic.
So how was that in the dream?
Because the only reason why ants would be drawn to urine is because there's sugar in the urine.
Yeah.
I would have never thought about that.
Yeah, me
either. And now, I don't want your listeners to think, you know, that, you know, it's all about biology. That's not the point at all. It's about wisdom, Dr. Dave. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
The fact that Kalfin caught what nature was saying to this man, both about his biological situation, but of course then in his inner world, there was something also about the issue of sugar and sweetness and all those kind of issues that were very much alive in that dreamer's psychological and emotional life as well. But,
okay, well,
you know, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that story kind of leads me to, I listened recently to one of your teleseminars, and it was about the archetypal patterns that Lance Armstrong was playing out.
Yep.
And I listened to another one about patterns in the world of business. Tell us a little bit about the Lance Armstrong story, because I thought that was very powerful.
Yeah, I mean, yes, my work is, I'm very interested in patterns. I'm interested in what these configurations are around us, because the configurations are about nature and about archetypes, okay? So I'm looking all the time. So with the Lance Armstrong piece, again, it's not that I was particularly interested in Lance Armstrong, but I'm interested in the issue, okay?
Yeah.
So like many of us, you know, just said, oh my God, the blood doping, he threw all these people under the bus, he did these terrible things, and that's all very true.
And he was a hero, like so many other heroes out there in politics and world leaders and so on.
Yeah, I mean, he was elevated to the ranks of hero, and the only thing that was really heroic about what he had done, if you really want to cut to the chase of the archetype of the hero, was what he did for cancer. Athletes are not necessarily heroes. I mean, look, okay. I grew up in a world where I was a very good athlete and all that, and I loved athletics. I still enjoy athletics. But it's not, you know, is Wilt Chamberlain, I mean, you sound like you and I are similar ages, the old-timers, or today, Shaquille O'Neal, is he really a hero? He's a hero on the court. But anyway, so he was elevated, which is kind of a dangerous thing right there. So then I began looking at, obviously, the guy was inflated. Because here he wanted to get to this level where he was the best of the best of the best. He was on Olympus. He was swimming or cycling with Zeus and all of them, better than most of them. And I knew there was something not yet settled about this for me. When I looked at inflation issues, about the incredible narcissism, psychopathy. And I don't know if you listened to the second lecture, but then I do think I hit it on a, I think I hit the issue of the second one. And in preparing for it, I went to go look at a lot of the Lance Armstrong videos on YouTube.
Yeah.
And there was one series that, that gave me the clue. They were when he was diagnosed with testicular cancer. And the, again, to summarize the story, the doctors had told him he had, you know, little chance of any to survive this cancer. And it was spreading. And then, so that's all part of one of the videos. The next part of it, they show these pictures of someone, him, I don't know, just a, somebody else, going through surgeries where they had the, from stem to stern, they opened this guy up. I didn't know this. Most of us didn't know it. They cut his stomach open to get cancer. This guy also had brain surgery. Do you know that?
I don't think I did know that. I don't recall that.
I didn't. And then it dawned on me, this guy was facing the hounds of hell.
Uh-huh.
He was facing death. And what is a likely response? Two major responses, two archetypal pattern responses to death. One is, okay, if I'm going to die, let me just die. And it's over right now. Let me pick my coffin and just go.
Yeah.
The other one is, I'm not going to die. I'm immortal. And I'm going to do everything to prove I'm immortal.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to be younger. I'm going to be faster. I'm going to be as good as I was when I was a kid, and on and on. And what happened was at that moment, he was propelled into the archetypal field of eternal youth, the poor archetype, poor eternus. And it was motivated by one major issue, which was he could not face the strong possibility or the scent of death that he was living with.
Mm-hmm.
And he was avoiding it on every turn. And at that moment, it was interesting because I suddenly felt compassion for this guy. I mean, yeah, I think he still has done a lot of terrible things. But I thought, you know what? He's caught, and this gets to the next part of my work, he was caught in the archetypal field of the denial of death.
Yes.
And it's a highly, again, patterns and field. It's pattern. Pattern means it's a familiar expression. You greet somebody you like, you hug them, you give them a kiss, or you shake their hand, or come on to my house, let's have a glass of wine, let's sit and talk, or let's sit by the fire. These are all pattern things we do that have been there from the beginning of time. And I realized, you know what, this guy is possessed and he's taken over by the field of the denial of death.
Yeah.
And
I see that you recently did a Blog Talk Radio podcast on Oscar Pistorius, so I don't know if that's a different pattern or what. What's your take?
Dr. Dave, it's the same thing. I mean, when I did my research on this guy, again, I was interested that here we have yet again another fallen hero, right? So-called fallen hero. And I don't know if he's been found guilty now, but he's being so accused of this. You read his story. 11 months of age, they amputated his legs. He has his knee. He has both mm-hmm. knees. From the knee down, he's amputated. You know, you look at him today, I mean, he's this gorgeous athlete, a fantastic runner and a great dancer and all those things. And on one hand, when you watch him run, they seem to call him the blade runner today because he runs these blades on his legs.
Right.
It's somewhat bizarre. But the other big piece is, it's not the question bizarre. You say how wonderful and resilient, and you know, I love that. My father's also an amputee, so I have a special feeling for somebody who has a leg cut, you know?
Yeah.
I grew up with this. Anyway, I realized, you know what? Not that this was a new insight, but it hit me yet again. The human psyche is not ready to deal with these traumas. We're not wired for this. How do you live knowing that your legs have been cut off? You know, we create all these denial mechanisms, these incredible denial mechanisms that we live with every day, and they get better and better. And after a while, I'm dancing, and I'm running, and I'm swimming, and he's making love, and he's doing all this thing. Who thinks about it? Now, people could say, isn't that wonderful? Well, it's wonderful you can be resilient, but you should never forget the origins. And I gave that quote from Jung's Red Book, where Jung says, if you have been to hell, you become hell.
Mm.
And then he goes on to say, and don't ever forget where you come from. Oh, my God. Now, somebody wrote back. I'm going to respond to them because I wrote that in the blog and also the radio show. And I said, Michael, but you know, you're not condemning people, are you, to always be in hell? No, it's not the point. I would never condemn. That's not it. The point is that you know something other people don't know. Can you make that conscious? You see, that's the issue. Can you make that contact and live with the fact that, yeah, thank God I'm resilient. Thank God I got the courage. My father's 96, 97 years old, one leg, one eye. He hasn't stopped.
Wow.
I hope to God I got that.
Yeah.
Speaks three languages. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
But he knows. He knows he's got a one leg and one eye. He's never denied that.
Yeah, somehow Jungian psychology is all about holding the opposites, holding both of those and not getting totally identified with, say, the side that wants to overcome death and denial.
Well, you're right. And you see, this is one of the things I was drawn to. Go back to the backstory with Jung. Jung is one of the few that really will talk about evil. He'll talk about evil as a reality, as one of the things that's part of the individual and collective psyche. Evil is built in, like benevolence and transcendence and wonder, as is the other pieces. And I think it's hard to live with both, but I think that's what's demanded of us. But I don't think we are equipped at this point in time. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the horrors. I mean, you know, I did a teleconference on that Newtown, Connecticut shooting. We had over 600 people involved in that call. I mean, do we know what the heck it is that runs through us? It's like the winds blow through a shattered pane of glass. The winds of psyche, they blow through and we shiver, right? And then say, what was that?
Yeah.
People going out and doing this stuff, doing it.
Well, you're not afraid to get out on a limb and talk about some of these current events and linking them to the deeper parts of the psyche. You've referred to dreams a couple of times. I've had a long-standing interest in dreams myself, and I see that you offer a certificate training sequence in dream patterning. What is dream patterning?
Dream patterning is it's built clearly on Jung's work and von Franz's work on archetypal patterns, and also draws a lot on Dr. Kaufman's work on the objective image. And a lot of what this work is about is looking at the archetypal nature of an image. What that means, for instance, is think of almost any image, a vacation. Think of an image of a vacation. Say someone dreams of a vacation. Now, clearly, that's a highly patterned activity. Now, many, many different things happen. We have what the funny movie that Chevy Chase made, something about a vacation where it's all a night. Crazy what happens. It's a great comedy, but it's all these nutty things happen. And families almost drown and all of that, and they need a vacation from the vacation because it was so stressful. So with archetypal patterning, if you look at a vacation as an image, you say a vacation. The root of it, I mean, I'm not sure what the Latin root is. I'd have to find that. But as we understand vacations, it's to vacate something.
Mm-hmm.
To vacate usually the activity and the way we live our lives every day. To do something different, to begin to restore ourselves. Like even, you know, similarly, ristorante, ristore. And in parts of Northern Italy, some of the restaurants are called ristore. Or ristorante, it means to restore oneself.
Yeah.
Vacation, so as an archetypal root, is to look at taking time away from the daily grind of a life. No matter how much we love it, we need some time away to do other things. So regardless of what individuals would say, oh my God, remember family vacations, all Uncle Charlie and Uncle Louie and all this kind of stuff? Remember the nightmares and the arguments and the fight? Well, and they say, so vacations are terrible. Well, that's your opinion. But that's not the image. That's not the reality. That's your reality does not shape the universal reality.
Mm-hmm.
So much of our work, excuse me, let me get a little bit of water as we talk. The work here is really looking to discern what is the universal aspect of an image. And then seeing what the individual relationship to that is.
Can you give us an example of one or more dreams that you've worked with that stand out?
I'll give you probably one of the best. I just wrote an article. There's a book coming out. I think it's called Dream Amplification. I'll go back to the other phone. And Eros Shalit and Nancy Ferlati are the editors, and they invited me to do a chapter, so I just did one, and they included this in it. A man dreams, a man who's in his early to mid, maybe mid-60s. He dreamt that he finds this wood underwater. Say like a cashew wood underwater, and it's all log length. maybe 40, 50, 60 feet long, and it's bound on both sides. So it's intentionally been, you know, bound by cord.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow he knows that the wood's been underwater for 50 years. And he thinks, well, I want to try to get some of the wood up, and if it's any good, I want to burn it in my wood stove, which is what people do up here. They burn, you know, a lot of wood heat and all that.
That's right. You're in Vermont.
I'm in Vermont. Yeah. And so that's the dream. So again, the dream is a man finds this cache of wood underwater. It's been limbed already, but it's full tree length, like 60 foot, 40 foot, whatever, and it's bound from the front end and the back end.
Okay.
And he thinks, if I could just get the wood up, that's part of the Freudian piece, of, get the wood up, and
yeah,
then we will see, you know, if it's any good, if it's not punky, because usually wood underwater is very punky, it's all rotten, right?
Yeah.
If it's not punky, I've got to cut it up and use it in my wood stove. So, okay, so we could do some fun things with the Freudian piece of getting the wood up. It's a Viagra dream. Well, it's not.
Don't
put that at all. Anyway, about 3 days before the dream, I had an incredible synchronicity before the man presented the dream to me. He was a relatively new patient, okay? So I'm in my car driving to work, and there's this NPR radio show. And it was about a man up in Michigan who had a lumber yard who somehow found wood underwater.
Huh.
And it was bound like this, all tree length, right? I had never heard about this before.
Yeah.
So the guy says, well, look, since they have a lumber mill, let me get the wood up again and see what's there, because in all likelihood, it's all ruined. Because you know what happens to wood underwater. It's okay. So anyway, he gets it on the lumber mill, he gets his blades going and all that, and he opens it up, and he debarks it, and he begins getting into the wood, and he finds, lo and behold, to his total amazement, this is the outer world story now, the most exquisitely grained wood he has ever seen in his life. And he begins to call people, say, what's happening? What is this I've just found here? And they say, well, this is one of the ancient ways of curing wood.
Uh-huh.
And then I begin doing my research, and I talk to a lot of people, as I like to do as an extrovert, and people who and I say, does anybody know anything? And I get on and tear. Do you know? And then I did my research, and I found, lo and behold, the Viking sailors, one of the greatest shipbuilders of all times, used this as a way of curing wood.
Mm.
And then I found out some of the greatest musical instruments were built with wood that had been stored underwater.
Interesting.
So rather than being wood that's ruined, it's, you know, I mean, look, I just put Brazilian cherry wood in my floor in the living room. And it's expensive, maybe $7 a board foot. This wood, forget it, hundreds and hundreds of dollars a board foot. Mm. It's invaluable, okay? But anyway, so we have this dream, and I get all this information, right? So he tells me a dream. I say, I can't believe the synchronicity, which is a meaningful event in and of itself, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I say to him, do you know anything about this kind of wood? He said, no, never heard anything. And so we worked on the dream, and I said, now I'm going to tell you a story. And I told him the story I just told you about the wood.
Right.
I said, do you realize you have just found in your psyche something that's been curing for 50 years, which is of some of the most incredible value imaginable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part A. Part B is, I said, this is a gift. If we can translate this and understand it and find out where it is and all that, I said, but there's a very disturbing part of the dream. And this is the challenge to catch this one. I said, but you want to burn that in your wood stove. Now, of course, we want wood for the stove and all that, and we think of the inner stove, the inner alchemical stove and all that. I say, but guess what, though? This is not a wood that you put in your stove. You can go out and buy wood to heat your house with. You don't take a wood of this value. So it's saying here that you have the potential to misuse something of immense value.
That's interesting. I caught part without knowing the story, but you know, I could just kind of feel, oh, something really of value here. But that part B is interesting that you picked up on. I don't think I would have caught that.
Well, this is really a lot of what I learned by being with Dr. Kaufman, the precision of working with images.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the guy, as I write in the article, so it's public. I said, you know, this is a guy who was a tremendous educator, he's a great clinician. Students went from all over the world to be around him, and he was retired now. Uh-huh. And he wanted to do other things. He wanted to do very different things with his life. I said, you know what? You got to go back to teaching. You got to go back part-time, go to community college, doesn't matter. Do something to feed that hunger of yours. Now, I said, look, we will never know fully what all the expressions of that dream are. What are all the things in your life that are akin to this beautiful wood? But what we do know is that you have something that's a treasure and you have to really value it. You don't misuse it. And about aging for 50 years, he was, I think, 65 or so at the time of the dream.
Yeah.
I said, what about that many years ago? What happened 50 years ago? So he's, what, 15 or so?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was a time he developed this love of nature and love of the outdoors. And everything from the solar system to the frogs to whatever.
The woods.
The woods, all of it, yeah.
Yeah.
And this guy had a love of learning that was just infectious. I loved working with him on so many levels. So, you know, that dream in so many ways captures almost everything we've talked about in this entire call today, both in terms of, yes, this is what we teach in a training program, and it's so easy to miss this stuff because what do you think, what do you feel?
Yeah.
And there are facts. You know, Jung said there are psychic facts, there's psychic inevitabilities. And this is what I think is the tremendous beauty and richness of what Jung had to offer us. That psyche is teaching us every day. It's like being with a great chef. Okay, you know what? You go into the kitchen with a great chef, just shut up for a while. You got to tell them the way you cook. You cook your pasta and you cook the fish. I know how I cook my fish. I'm here because I want to learn from a great chef. It's not going to diminish me as a cook. Let me learn. You talked about great interviews, Charlie Rose and Terry Gross and all that. Do we have to tell them what we do all the time? That's what subjectivity is all about, Dr. Dave. You know, and that's where I think we've taken Jung's work and we've really misused it in so many ways. Where we have to say, Terry Gross, let me tell you how I interview people. Well, she may want to engage you with that after a while, but wouldn't it be nice to know what she does, how she got there, the way she does it, to watch that chef, watch some of the great chefs, Lydia and some of the other ones,
yeah,
like Julia Child, and watch what they do. I mean, my God.
Well,
psyche's teaching us this stuff. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I'm interrupting you, but short of a full-blown Jungian, it raises an interesting question, you know, of what one can do on their own and what one can do working with a talented therapist. So short of a full-blown Jungian analysis, how might a person, a listener here, recognize some of the major underlying patterns at work in their own life? Do you see that as possible or not?
I do. It's a great, great question. I think Charlie Rose and Terry Gross would love that kind of question.
Oh, good.
You look at what gets constellated in your life. Look at what begins to happen. One of the early discoveries today was about repetition, the powers of repetition in the human psyche. The beauty of that discovery was things repeat. The shadow of that is things repeat. So if you look at what begins to repeat itself, what the familiar refrain is in your life, you're going to catch one of the major patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you can begin the work of identifying it and translating it. So I think if you become really observant about your life, it's a great, great way to start this. So, you know, it's interesting. Every time I go out, I'm drawn to this particular kind of thing. I'm drawn to this particular kind of person. Or no matter where I go, I seem to fall of the same thing, the same crack in the sidewalk. I fall on no matter where I go.
Yeah.
And then you say, okay, look, well, what is this? What's the story? There is an implicit story there. And, you know, right there, you've already begun the process of developing an interest in how psyche communicates and how psyche talks. And it's going to start right there. And that could help you a lot. Like relationships. I mean, to just say, oh, my God, you and your wife get into whatever, you and your partner get into a problem, it's because you're just so pig-headed and she's just so this. Well, that's too easy. I mean, you know, if you look at the natural world and what we've learned from, go back to your early term self-organization, life evolves into more complexity after there are periods of disruption. Disruption is a necessary precondition for a new level of novelty and a higher level of meaning.
That's such a hard lesson to learn. I mean, I've had to learn that lesson over and over again, and trying to develop an attitude when that adversity comes along or that challenge comes along to remember what you just said.
It's huge. I mean, how many nights do you want to spend on the couch? I'm going to stop that behavior. I'm never going to do that again.
Yeah.
But it really is profound. And, you know, Guggenbuehl Craig wrote about that beautifully in a book called Marriage Dead or Alive. And he said, look, do you have a marriage of well-being or a marriage of salvation? If you want to really take, like, just staying with the marriage example there, that he said, if you want to take it seriously, you say for whatever reason, marriage is your way towards individuation in the self. Can you, as a couple, take this on and say, we're going to hold together when the storm begins to really get going, when the winds start howling, hold tight, and it's going to be rough, but we're doing this as a way both to live a better life together, a more meaningful life. That could be the glue to hold it. And look, I know it's tough, you know. This is very, it's tough stuff. It's tough stuff when I think ever you let psyche have a real place in your life. A lot of beauty, we'd say nice things and all of the bells and whistles. But you're right. And I love that, boy, you're being so honest about it. It's a challenge.
You mentioned several times that you're an extrovert, and I'm hearing that you're very out in the world, and yet you've done all this reading and reflection and so on. Where do you find the time? How do you create space in your life for that inner part of your work?
Well, right now, I need to have more of that time because I'm doing so much in the outer world. And I'm
you are.
It's hitting a point. It's hitting a point where I know I'm really very happy. If I could spend 5 to 6 hours a day reading and writing, I could do it. I have that kind of temperament now. And, you know, for years I would be doing nonstop. I'd do my work and then study, and I'd be up at 4 a.m. writing and reading. I mean, I've always had that kind of dedication. It's more difficult when I get older to try to keep on burning on both ends. And that's why I've got to stop burning on both ends.
Yeah.
But, you know, getting back to your question, I can answer it this way, and I got to run to a client in a minute. You know when you've had a good meal. You say, my God, this is great. And you know when you're sitting reading something or when you're with a client, I love my client work and my teaching, you say, this is great. And especially as we get older, you know when you're not having a good meal.
Yeah.
And that, I think, it needs to become part of our lens. So, you know what? Why am I at this restaurant? I know I don't like this food that much. I know that one down there has got some great stuff. And I guess I could leave you on this note. A friend of mine gave me a little throw pillow. Another Italian guy. Life is too short to drink bad wine.
Well, yeah, I know you've got a client. We're bumping up against the hour here, and you've got a client to meet with. And I skipped over a whole bunch of questions here that I could have plied you with and was looking forward to. But I just enjoy your whole style of conversation and am happy to have been able to spend this time with you. So, Dr. Michael Conforti, it's been great to speak with you, and I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's a pleasure, and thank you so much for your genuine interest and your engaging quality with it. So thank you, and if you're ever interested, I'll be back in a heartbeat. So if the time ever comes up, I'm there. Thank you so much.
I get a very down-to-earth feeling from Dr. Conforti. I suppose it's the mix of what I think might be a Brooklyn accent and the warmth of his Italian background that he shared with us. I conducted this interview without the benefit of having read either of his two books. There is Threshold Experiences, The Archetype of Beginnings, which he wrote in 2007, and the earlier Field, Form, and Fate, Patterns in Mind, Nature, and Psyche. I hope at some point to get around to these. I love that he's written a book on threshold experiences because that strikes me as a very important pattern right off the bat. Joseph Campbell talks beautifully about the crossing of the threshold in The Hero with a Thousand Faces. If we had had time, I would have liked to hear what Dr. Conforti's take on that is. Also, I'm intrigued by the subtitle of his earlier book, Patterns in Mind, Nature, and Fate. It's the fate part that particularly intrigues me. And I planned to ask him about that before we ran out of time. If I had to guess, I would think it might be an extension of his notion that field precedes form. Might he be suggesting that there is already an existing field that we grow into as our life progresses? Certainly Jung suggests that we're not only pushed by the past, but also drawn by the future. Dr. Conforti did stress that he'd be happy to come back on the show, so let me know if you'd be eager for that. He's very prolific in offering complimentary teleseminars as a way of promoting his workshops in Assisi, Italy, and the other programs he offers. You can find full information about pretty much everything he's up to at www.assisiinstitute.com, including a link to his blog, which is called Patterns We Live By. And of course, you can purchase his books using our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Nikki Amaria Sargent, and I wanted to say thank you. I want to say I was a therapist in a clinical practice in a rural community that for many years, and it didn't have, still doesn't have, much in the way of public mental health resources, let alone training opportunities for its therapists. My personal journey led me into analysis, and then analytic training, and finally to be a certified union analyst. My rural colleagues supported me in all of this, despite questioning the relevance and the value of what I was doing. I still live in that country or community, though I practice in Palo Alto. Your podcasts have helped me learn of fields of study and persons of amazingly rich research and competence I know I have enjoyed greatly. I've told my rural cohorts about your interviews. This has helped them grow as clinicians, better serve their patients, understand me, and get CEU units without extensive driving and big carbon footprints. I'm so grateful for all your time and efforts to put together quality programming, bringing the treasures of depth psychology into contemporary discussion, and helping weave together communities of kindred spirits. Thank you, Dr. Dave.
And thank you, Nikki, for that ringing endorsement and for encouraging others to take the step to contribute to the financial support of Shrink Wrap Radio. Of course, another form of support is that provided by our volunteer transcriptionists, and I'm happy to announce that we have some new transcripts on the site. Jill Ebsworth has transcribed Shrink Wrap Radio number 295, Mythology and the Spiritual Journey with Richard Nagel, Ph.D. Thank you for that, Jill. And Gloria Ullman has transcribed Shrink Wrap Radio number 339, Infant Research and Neuroscience Implications for Psychotherapy with Judith Rustin. So thanks to you, Gloria, for that piece of work. I really appreciate it. And here's an interesting fact, speaking of the interview with Judith Rustin, that interview has been downloaded more than twice the number of times of any other interview that I've conducted all these years, and I'm not really sure why. It's a wonderful interview, very authoritative, etc., etc., but same thing is true for others. If anybody can solve that mystery for me, I'd be interested. You heard Nikki in her endorsement mention the value of the continuing education units that are available through our site. At this point, I believe we have more than 80 CE units in a variety of areas, too many to list here. They are reasonably priced at less than $10 a unit, so just go to the store tab on our site for a complete listing. And don't forget that we have an app for iOS devices and for Android devices, and you'll find full info for that under our app tab at the top of the screen at shrinkwrapradio.com. We have several specials going on with the Jung platform. Just click on the Jung platform icon in the right-hand sidebar on our site, and that'll take you to several offers. One of the most current ones is a chance to get a DVD of Coleman Barks, the famous translator for Rumi's poetry, giving a performance. And the cost of the DVD is $19.75, minus a 10% discount for using my code of Dr. Dave, which is spelled just D-R-D-A-V-E. Finally, I hope you'll help to spread the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to all and sundry. My goal is nothing short of world domination. You know I'm kidding, right?
Hi, this is Ruth Ann and Walt Amberstone, founders of the Tarot School and the Reader Studio.
And you're on the couch at Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Ruth Ann and Walt Amberstone, who will be my next guests. More about that in a bit, but first, let's check out a few recent emails from our listener community. Here's one from new listener Amanda, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I am a new listener and have just finished catching up on the most recent podcasts from my iTunes subscription. Only 217 more downloaded from your website to go." Thank you so much for all of the thought, work, and love you've put into creating these podcasts. I finished an undergraduate degree in communication about a year ago, and it took me the full 4 years to have a decent map of the field. When I realized I wanted to live my life as a counselor or psychotherapist, I felt overwhelmed by the task of independently navigating the field of psychology so that I could make an informed decision about which graduate programs to apply to. You have helped make that project much lighter and more enjoyable than I ever imagined. I'm also grateful that Shrink Wrap Radio helps me from getting intellectually bored at my peaceful gardening job. Sometimes I'll listen to back-to-back episodes the entire time I'm at work. Then when I get home, I can explore ideas that excited me in more depth. I also want to say that you inspire me and help me be compassionate toward myself. Sometimes I get down on myself for having too many interests and not enough focus. I can identify with that. And yes, we both need to be compassionate towards ourselves around that tendency. He says, "When I hear you doubting yourself in a similar way, it's easier for me to dismiss because you're so obviously an amazing, kind, knowledgeable, and contributing member of society. I look forward to the day when I have the breadth of knowledge that you do and have dabbled without the negative connotation in as many interests as you have." Thank you for that boost. I really appreciate it, Amanda. She goes on to write, "I'm looking at graduate programs to pursue a PsyD. I recently visited the California Institute of Integral Studies and fell in love with it, but I'm terrified by the price tag. Do you know of any other schools that similarly embrace the humanist existential approach, use experiential learning, and aren't afraid of spirituality? It would be especially great if there was something with a stronger focus on somatics. Thank you so much for everything you do and have done, Amanda." And then she says, "P.S., I've made a small donation as a placeholder for when I have more money to share. What you have given me is worth so much more than what I have so far returned to you." Amanda, I want to really thank you, first of all, for writing, taking time to write, and then going beyond that to make your financial donation, and just the spirit and the gratitude, I guess, that comes through in what you've written. It really means a lot to me. It warms my heart. I wish that I could give you some more suggestions. I know the graduate study is very expensive these days, and particularly when it's not supported by the state, as education less and less is supported by the state. But these freestanding institutions are very expensive. And no, I unfortunately can't think of another place to recommend. And as a matter of fact, there is one other place that comes to mind, right? And that's the Institute of for Transpersonal Psychology, ITP. I don't know that they'll be any less expensive, but I do think they may have a stronger emphasis on somatics and will also be very at home with a spiritual orientation. So check them out. They're located, I believe, in Menlo Park. And you should be able to find them on the internet. I won't go on at any more length since this episode has run so long, but do start listening to those 217 back episodes. You'll find a lot of good material there, as well as keeping up with the current ones. Here's another email, this one from Ralph, who's living in Germany these days. We've had some emails back and forth, and he writes, "Hello, David. Could I make a request for an interview? You've had many giants on your website, but there's one psychologist who has been neglected by almost everyone, Dr. Louis Breger, the author of Freud, Darkness in the Midst of Vision. This professor emeritus is the foremost expert on Freud living today. I have found his email address, and he gives that to me, but I won't put it on the air here. It would be exciting to hear him. Many thanks, Ralph." Ralph, that sounds like an excellent suggestion. I really appreciate it. I've added it to my very long to-do list, so I may or may not get down to it. It's always a task to juggle between the listener suggestions that I receive, the publicist suggestions that I receive, the people who've written books who contact me and let me know that they want to be interviewed, and my own interests, which I try to follow as well. And somehow I have to juggle between all of those, and I only put out one podcast a week. So it's just impossible to get to everything, but it goes into my hopper. Here's another one. "Dear Dr. Van Nuys, I'm currently a psychology student interested in depth psychology and other less mainstream psychology. I've listened to many of your podcasts over the past few years and especially enjoyed the Jonathan Shedler interview on the efficacy of psychodynamic therapy, as well as the one with Peter Todd. I have a suggestion as a possible guest for your show." Here comes another one. "His name is Chris Donahue, LCSW, CST. Not sure what CST stands for. He was the host of a show that aired on Logo TV called Bad Sex, and also has a book coming out this year. The following is from his website and does a much better job listing his credentials and achievements than I'm able to do." I'm going to skip over all that just in the interest of time, because you can go and look up Chris Donahue, which is spelled D-O-N-A-G-H-U-E. An interesting spelling of that. His first book, The New Sex, is due out in 2013. The book focuses on being sex positive, which means challenging our sex phobic and sex negative culture. It also explores the neurology of sex, acceptance of everything sexual and sexual diversity, acknowledging individual sexuality and natural sexual biology. And he gives the website, which is http://chrisdonahue.com, with that spelling that I gave earlier. "Hopefully this proves to be a good lead for you. Thanks for all the hard work you do putting these podcasts together. They've helped expand my knowledge and are a refreshing alternative to other podcasts that seem to be to focus on evidence-based treatments, seeming to dominate a good portion of psychology currently. Your loyal listener." And that's from Malcolm. Malcolm, it sounds like a great suggestion. I probably have not covered sexuality in as great detail as I should, considering considering the degree to which it occupies our consciousness and our lives and drives so much of our behavior. So I think that better wrap it up for today. I want to thank today's guest, Jungian analyst Dr. Michael Conforti, for sharing his work on archetypal patterns. I hope maybe we'll hear more from him in the future. Speaking of archetypal patterns, my next guests have spent their careers studying those patterns through the tool of the Tarot. So for a change of pace from all these Jungian analysts and neuroscientists, let's take a look from a different angle with Ruth Ann and Wald Amberstone, both of whom are longtime students of esoteric wisdom and teachers of the Tarot, and we'll be discussing ways in which Tarot and psychology support one another. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Shrink Wrap Radio, all the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.